KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
From the studios of KPFK, Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On today's show, David Dayan joins us to discuss his powerful new book about the corporate monopolies that control the American economy. It's called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Then award-winning reporter Aaron Glantz discusses his new book that takes on the villains of the housing crisis. It's called Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Corporations in the U.S. have never been happier. They have friends in high places, in the White House, in Congress, the Treasury, the Justice Department, all of which have helped to ensure the U.S. economy is more and more dominated by corporate monopolies. We turn now to David Dayan, the executive editor of The American Prospect, whose work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, Huffington Post, The Washington Post, The LA Times, and more. His first book, Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. And he now joins me to discuss his newest book called Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. He's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
So I love how you start with the first chapter of your book explaining to readers that monopolies are the reason why people keep getting deep vein thrombosis on long-haul flights. We live in a country where fewer and fewer corporations control whole industries. How is it that this is the state of the country today, given that we're supposed to have things like antitrust laws in place? This has been a problem historically in our country, and government has addressed it in the past, and we seem to have come right back to where corporate monopolies are becoming more common.
Yeah, I mean, you know, competition is supposed to be this great conservative value, right? That the free market has a bunch of competitors in it, and you get to pick and choose what is best for you, and people rise and fall on the strength of the quality of the product that they provide. And that's just not true anymore. I mean, sometime around the 1980s, the government basically gave up on antitrust policy. And as a result, you know, we have the situation that we're living through today, where a handful of companies control more and more sectors of the economy. And of course, one of the things that results from that is that quality suffers. So why should a monopolist give you a good product if you have nowhere else to go to get that product? And a perfect example of that is the airlines. So, you know, anyone that's traveled over the last several years knows that it's an increasingly miserable experience where you're packed in like sardines into a smaller and smaller space. The situation with deep vein thrombosis is the fact that more people, when they're shoved into a very small leg room on a long haul flight of over 4 or 5 hours, they get blood clots in their legs. This is kind of a common thing. It's known as economy class syndrome. It's seen as something that's very endemic to long haul flights. There have been activist groups that have tried to get the Federal Aviation Administration to change the rules and put some minimum requirements in for seat pitch, which is that's the technical term for how far your seat is from the person in front of you. And the airlines have been able to stop this over and over. And it's really a few airlines. Four airlines control 80% of all the routes domestically in the United States. And they have just fought this over and over again because, of course, every inch that they take away from your legroom, they get to put another row with more paying customers in the back of the plane. And of course, in the pandemic, what we're seeing now is they're selling the middle seats in many of these large airlines, even though you're supposed to have social distancing. And, you know, obviously, if you're packed, you know, shoulder to shoulder with somebody, you're not distanced nearly enough from them. So this is a function of power that is in the hands of just a few airlines. And really, for your personal airline to get where you want to go, in most cases, you have one choice. And when you have one choice, quality suffers.
Right. And the airline industry, you're right, is one of many, many industries in the country that are increasingly basically able to set their own rules because there's fewer and fewer of them. And also, there are other industries where if you scratch the surface, you find monopolies where you didn't realize there were. Let's talk about the food industry. Talk about going into supermarkets and seeing shelves of what appear to be a huge variety of products, but in reality, there's actually not that many companies that control our food system. So give us a sense of how bad the food system's monopoly is and what the direct impact is on our food.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of from beginning to end, right? So you could start at the farm. And everything on the farm is part of a very concentrated industry, whether you're talking about meat and meat packing companies, which you know, are very, very narrowed. Two or three companies control most of beef and pork and chicken and dairy products. Also, in terms of produce, there are very few companies that sell you the seeds. And you have to buy them every year. As you know, Monsanto has a patent on seeds, and you can't use them more than 1 year at a time. And so this affects the farmer's ability to eke out a living. The very large factory farms, the concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, create major environmental hazards wherever they go. For refuse, you know, one of the big places for CAFOs is hog farms in North Carolina. And of course, North Carolina is a magnet for hurricanes. And you have these lagoons where the waste product for hogs goes, and it just runs off during a hurricane and contaminates entire areas of North Carolina. If you're living near one of those facilities and disproportionately you have Black and Latino people living in near in and around those facilities, your life is miserable. You know, the smell just stays with you, kind of, it's ever present in your life. So that's, you know, sort of in terms of the raw product. And then when it gets to your table and gets to your grocery store, you think there are all these different distributors of different kinds of peanut butter, or jelly, or, you know, whatever, but it's usually just sort of dressed up as a different label made by the same company. So there are, you know, mainly two or three companies that make all the peanut butter and two or three companies that make all the toothpaste in the country. So that affects, you know, choice. It affects innovation in terms of if somebody has a better idea, it's harder for them to get shelf space in your grocery store and get to market. It has an effect on sort of the flourishing of diversity in our lives and in our food. You know, I think that this is the food sector is one of the prime examples of a monopolized industry.
And the industry knows that if they create many varieties of the same thing, they can take up shelf space, which of course means more eyeballs on their products, etc. Let's talk about a topic close to your and my heart, journalism. Monopolies, you write, are why hundreds of journalists became filmmakers, then back to writers, then unemployed. I remember the great writer Ben Bagdikian with his book Media, about media monopolies, years ago, warning that a smaller and smaller number of corporations owned media outlets. So how badly is journalism impacted by corporate monopoly?
It's getting really bad, and it's made worse by the fact that so much of the funding and the revenue source for journalism comes from digital advertising, and that is dominated by Google and Facebook. And those two companies, which control 80 or 90% of new advertising on the internet, deprive an outlet of having this audience that they built through their talent and being able to monetize it in any way. It makes it impossible to sell advertising through one of your firms. So there was a study recently from the University of North Carolina that shows that 1,800 papers, newspapers, have closed over the last several years, and there are now 1,300 communities in the United States that have no daily news outlet. So these are deserts, and it's interesting. You know, I wrote the book about a year ago, but one of the things I mentioned, and this was before COVID-19 was a thing, was that news deserts actually help cause and further pandemics, because epidemiologists rely on news sources to figure out and track where viruses are moving in throughout a particular region. And so, you know, cutting off with news deserts actually has probably made it harder for people to track the pandemic, in particularly in rural communities. So that was the problem. The thing I was talking about in that particular headline is this thing that was called the pivot to video. And the pivot to video was that Facebook decided about 4 or 5 years ago that everything they wanted to do was going to be in video. And if you were a news outlet or a publisher that really wanted to capture the attention of folks, you had to get to video in order to find your people on Facebook. And of course, everyone congregates to Facebook. And so you have to sort of follow their rules, whatever rules they decide to make up. So tons of digital media outlets decided to become film studios, essentially. They scrapped a lot of their news staffs, their writing staffs. They told people to make short videos instead, and they pivoted like this. And then it was revealed that Facebook was essentially lying to advertisers about how many people were watching videos on Facebook, and didn't disclose that to them for about a year. And after that, Facebook said, oh, well, so much for the pivot to video, we're pivoting back. And so all of these publishers that changed their entire business model to move to video were suddenly stuck. They were completely out of luck. And a lot of them went under. And I've talked two journalists who were fired from these various companies that pivoted and then had nowhere else to go. So this shows you, and a lot of the book shows you this, the control that monopolies have, that they can make up their own laws, their own rules, and have everybody else within a market have to follow those rules. You know, when we talk a lot about deregulation, and there really is kind of no such thing as deregulation. There's regulation that's done in a public way by democratically elected officials and regulators, and then there's private regulation that is done in corporate boardrooms for the interest of those corporations. And that's
no one ever talks about that.
No one ever talks about that. And that's what we have now. We have regulation by and for corporations. And that's the effect of deregulation. So the choice is whether you want us to make rules for economies and markets and people and society in the public interest or in the private interest of corporations.
Let's talk about banks and banking, something that you have studied for a long time and that is a big part of your book. You talk about how the banking monopoly is a big reason why there are monopolies among every other economic sector. What do you mean by that?
Well, banks play a key role in mergers and acquisitions, which it's known as M&A on Wall Street. And these M&A bankers advise companies and tell them if and when to buy other companies. And their income, of course, is derived from whether or not they're successful in getting these companies to buy other companies. And so you have this very large and powerful sector on Wall Street that is completely self-interested in consolidating the economy and concentrating various markets. And that's, you know, how it goes about. They fight with each other to get a certain amount of market share in advising companies. And just think about it. If a bank is advising you on mergers and acquisitions, are they going to tell you, no, don't buy that company? Don't merge with that company. Don't acquire that other company. That would literally be cutting off their supply of money, right? So, having this M&A be, and M&A has become a bigger part of bank balance sheets, of their profit centers. Having that take place is a spur to more monopolies. And what we've seen is that merger activity in the last 5 years is at almost a peak level historically. My fear is after the pandemic, you're going to have a lot of small, sick companies or bankrupt companies that'll get scooped up by the remaining survivors, and we'll see an acceleration of this trend.
So when we have this sort of monopoly, really stifling the economy, because that's essentially what it's doing, and there's something that those, you know, the backers of corporate power never want to admit, as you said, that this is in fact stifling the economy, that there are regulations, ones set by corporations themselves in order to maximize their profits. This seems to me the beginning of a downward spiral for this great American economy, and the U.S. has prided itself for years on innovation and leading the world in technological and other innovations. It seems as though this ultimately puts the corporate profits of these monopolies over not just consumers, but even just the actual industry itself that's in question.
It does absolutely hurt innovation, and it hurts startup activity. It hurts the ability for the business of America to thrive. Mm-hmm. Startup activity has absolutely cratered in the last 40 years. New business formation is way, way down. There are entire sectors like technology where your only chance, if you have a good idea, is to put it out there and hope that one of the big major tech firms buys you. They call it the kill zone. There's a zone where if you are a young business starting up, your only hope is to get bought, because if not, you're going to get crushed. And we see this with Facebook buying up Instagram and buying WhatsApp, and then trying to buy and being unsuccessful in buying Snapchat, but then making their own version of Snapchat that lives on Facebook to crush them. So this is the kill zone, and it's a real problem for a couple of reasons. Number one, quality. One of the chapters is about Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has municipal broadband. It's the fastest broadband in the world. It's about a 10 gigabyte broadband service that they deliver through their public utility, the electric utility. It's a fiber optic cable, and it's a fabulous service. But the telecom industry made a law in the state of Tennessee that no municipal broadband can go past the service area of that utility. And so you go 3 minutes outside of Chattanooga and they only have dial-up, and parents send their kids to Starbucks parking lots to catch the Wi-Fi so they can do their homework. So we could have nice things, right? We could have that municipal broadband, super fast internet all over the world. They can do it in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They can do it all over the country. But the reason we don't is monopoly power from the concentrated telecom sector. This also is a regional issue for inequality. All these areas in the Midwest and the Plain States that are struggling, a big cause of that is this sort of winner-take-all economic system that we have, where the big companies are located on the coasts, and there are mostly chains in these areas. The small businesses have gone away, and the wealth of these regions and these communities get sucked up into these monopolists and pushed out to corporate treasuries. And so we don't have the money staying in the economy where it belongs. And, that has depressed these areas. It's led to, I'm sure you know the book Deaths of Despair, mm-hmm. by Deaton and Case. It's led to a lot of desperation. And this is a monopoly problem as much as it is everything else. So I think you're absolutely right in terms of how monopolies actually harm economies. They make them less vibrant. They make them more scattershot, where parts of the country are left behind, and it's a serious problem.
The issue of broadband, just to pick up on what you were saying earlier, of course, becomes even more important during this pandemic, when so many people have had to transition to being at home, children being online at school. And when you have just one company, if you're lucky, that delivers service in your area, you have to take what they give you and shut up. And you can't really argue or shop around. No conversation around monopolies would be complete without discussing Amazon, also a company that has taken advantage of the fact that we're in a pandemic. What better business model than having delivery straight to your doorstep while you're trying to avoid crowds? Amazon has minted money during this pandemic. How seriously has its monopoly power grown? Not just since the pandemic, because of course you said you wrote the book last year, but in general, it has sort of almost epitomized this idea of a monopoly corporation.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon is a phenomenon. About half of all e-commerce searches start at Amazon.
Wow.
And as e-commerce grows, obviously Amazon's going to get more powerful. Because of that position, if you are someone who wants to sell goods, you're inevitably going to open up a store on Amazon, because if you don't, you're not going to find anybody. That's where the eyeballs are. So that really traps these what are called third-party sellers into Amazon's marketplace, and Amazon really creates its own almost private law, this private government, the terms by which it gives to these third-party sellers, where it gets involved in their transactions, it takes a large cut out of everything that's being sold, it sets up the logistics network for how things are sold and moved across. It commingles your inventory with other people's inventory if it's the same product, and if their product is defective and it's sent out even though it was your order, It wasn't your product, but if it's defective, you get called out for it because they have a very customer-centric kind of quality to them. So you could get your account suspended because Amazon sent somebody else's product to your customer. Amazon's marketplace is weirdly almost anarchic in terms of all of the sabotage that goes on among sellers between one another, fake reviews, counterfeit goods. You'll have individuals blow up their rival's product and take pictures of it and put it on the internet to try to that their rivals are not delivering a good product. And Amazon, even though it's their marketplace, they kind of have a hands-off policy with all of this. And all they do is they step in at the end and they suspend you. And if you're suspended, it's very hard to get out. There's a whole network that is built up of these consultants that try to help people get out of Amazon jail, essentially. And there are all these really Byzantine layers of who you have to contact and who you have to call. And at the end of that chain, literally, they call it a Jeff letter, and you have to send an email to Jeff Bezos. So the richest man in the world, you have to send an email to him in order to try to get your account as a third-party seller just trying to scrape by and selling random goods on Amazon. That's what you have to do to get out of jail. So it's a kind of a dehumanizing environment. It subjects people to the sort of whims of this large corporation, and it's a loss of control, as I said before. And there's this sort of palpable fear around it. And that's just the third-party sellers. There are all sorts of other things going on with Amazon and how they use their power, and a lot of that is in the book. But I thought that, you know, focusing on the sellers in this marketplace was a good way to show you the impacts of monopoly.
Well, there's so much more to talk about. People certainly can pick up your book and read all the details of the monopolies you discuss. But let's wrap up our conversation with a look at what needs to happen in order to start breaking up these monopolies. Clearly, corporations, when given the chance, will form monopolies. You have to have government regulation, you have to have antitrust laws actually being enforced, or maybe new and better laws being written. What needs to happen in order to really start to address this thing that, even from a capitalist perspective, is stifling the things that they love to boast about capitalism providing, such as innovation, lower prices, competition, etc.?
Right. And abundance. Yeah. I mean, you know, look at us in the where they say that we're this abundant society and we have a shortage of face masks, right? Like a piece of cloth with two strings tied around it. We don't have the capability to deliver to everyone who needs one. And that's a function of monopolies and middlemen and the fact that supply chains are concentrated in one part of the world, namely China and Taiwan. So what do we do about this? Well, I mean, we know what to do about this. We created laws in 1890 that speak to this. The Sherman Antitrust Act was 130 years ago. The Clayton Antitrust Act was over 100 years ago. Other anti-monopoly laws, like regulating chain stores and allowing for public options like a public bank or a public Wi-Fi system, like a community broadband system, are all out there. They're available to us. We know what to do. The thing that we don't have is that sort of public push from the bottom, a movement that says, we know that something is wrong with our economy. We know that this is not the way that we think things are supposed to go, and we want to see change. And so writing this book, I really wanted to get out into the world and talk to people about how these monopolies affect their daily life. And in doing that, I learned that people have an innate sense that something is very wrong, that as consumers, as workers, as citizens, as entrepreneurs, as small businesses, that they understand that something's wrong, that these companies have too much power over their lives. And it's a matter of building a movement that brings those people and their concerns together and forces the political system to act. And this can be done because this is how we got those laws in the first place.
Right.
You know, I mean, the progressive era, that is what happened. The farmers, laborers, small business owners, they came together and said, this doesn't work. The railroads are taking all of our profits away. The steel trust and the beef trust, and they're harming our workers and harming and making products that malfunction and are dangerous. We need to do something about this. And the political system eventually got the message and they did something about it. So that's what needs to happen again.
David, thank you so much for all the work you do and for spending this time with us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Nally. Thanks for your interest.
My guest is David Dayan, a frequent guest on our program. He's the executive editor of the American Prospect. We've been discussing his latest book, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There have been many books written about the financial recession of 2008 and the housing mortgage crisis that caused so many Americans to lose their homes. But what happened after the crash? A new book exposes how hedge fund investors and Wall Street executives took advantage of the housing crash and swooped in with government backing to scoop up hundreds of thousands of homes and rent them back to the public. That phenomenon was not just a massive transfer of wealth from ordinary Americans to the wealthy and powerful, but it also led to the lowest levels of home ownership in decades, in a country that prides itself on individuals owning property as a form of wealth creation. Many of the villains in that story, whom my guest calls homewreckers, are today part of Donald Trump's administration. Aaron Glantz now joins me. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, a two-time Peabody Award winner, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, PBS NewsHour, and more. And he joins me to discuss his new book, Homewreckers: How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
It's good to be with you.
I should say you were a one-time colleague of mine working at KPFA Pacifica Radio, and I'm very proud of everything that you've achieved since you've left Pacifica. So this book is, of course, not only quite remarkable to read, it's also very tragic. And you start out telling the story of your own home and how you came to purchase your very first home. Tell us that story and how, in a way, that was quite atypical of what happened after the crash.
Yeah, in 2009, I bought a house that I'm sitting in right now, actually, in the western side of San Francisco. It's not that big. It's 1,000 square feet. But anyone who knows anything about real estate in California knows what a blessing it is to have the opportunity to buy a house in San Francisco. And I had grown up here, and I had always felt that there was no chance that I would ever be able to own a house like my parents in the city that I grew up in. But then with the crash, it was like San Francisco was having a 50% off sale, right? There were foreclosures all over the place. And suddenly, there's this house up on a hill that fell into my price range. And my parents helped, and my wife's parents helped with the down payment. And now for the last 10 years, we've been living here with our, you know, fixed rate mortgage payment that doesn't go up, and every month we own a little bit more of our house. And as I look around, with gentrification and displacement being the bywords of the day, my colleagues and friends who rent constantly worry that their rent is going up and will they have to leave the region, I'm sitting here with a measure of comfort in knowing that I own my own home. And, you know, I wondered as an investigative reporter why more people weren't able to have this positive experience that I had. You know, you mentioned in your intro that the homeownership rate in 2016 hit a 50-year low. So that means that the homeownership rate didn't just go down during the housing bust years of 2008, 2009, 2010. It kept going down even during the supposed economic recovery in 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, and then bottomed out in 2016. So if there were other families like mine that were buying foreclosures and living in them, the homeownership rate would have remained stable. But instead, it kept going down. So what I wanted to know was, what happened to all of these 8 million homes, including 1 million here in California, that were lost to foreclosure? And that was the beginning of the investigation that led to the book Homewreckers.
So as you said, when the housing crash hit, values, home values dropped dramatically, of course, which ought to have then put them in the price range of Americans who couldn't afford them, maybe even Americans who had just lost their homes, you know, who might now be able to either rebuy their homes or buy other homes because the values had dropped. Instead, capitalists, as you call them, vulture capitalists, hedge fund investors, etc., swooped in and bought them up. How did that happen? Is it just that they were faster or had cash on hand? What enabled them to scoop up these homes over America, just ordinary individuals?
Well, I mean, part of it was that they were fast and they did have cash and they are rich. But that is not the whole story, right? And it can seem super complicated at times, which is why I thought it was appropriate to write a whole book about it. And what I try to do in the book is follow some individual homes that by following the homes, you kind of better understand these broad dynamics that were keeping housing out of reach for everyone. And I actually start out not even talking about homes at all, but about a bank based in Pasadena called IndyMac Bank, which was one of the biggest failures of the Great Recession. It failed in July 2008. Maybe some people might remember it because there were literal lines of depositors around the block. It was a bank collapse like we used to see in the Great Depression. And out of that, the government, in the form of the FDIC, the federal government, ended owning this bank, and they were looking for someone to buy it. And the person they sold it to was this former Goldman Sachs banker named Steve Mnuchin, who may be familiar to some of your listeners and viewers because he's now Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. Now, when the government sold this bank to Steve Mnuchin, including all of the loans on hundreds of thousands of homes all across this country, he didn't pay very much money. In fact, he paid nothing. So the group that he put together, which included George Soros and John Paulson and Michael Dell, the founder of Dell Computer, the government was so eager to get rid of this bank that it sold it to Mnuchin's group for nothing. And then they did something else. They subsidized him as he made foreclosures on families. And so basically, if he foreclosed on a family and lost money, then the government would pay him for up to 90% of his losses. And so we, the taxpayers, end up subsidizing Mnuchin and his group to the tune of more than $1 billion as he forecloses on 100,000 families, including 23,000 seniors. And many of them were in Southern California. And that's kind of like how I start the story, talking about a few houses that were caught up in this mess.
So this is, when you say the government subsidized them, we're talking about the Obama administration at that time, right?
Yeah, this is all happening when Obama was president. So as I go through the book and all of the home wreckers that I discuss, not only Steve Mnuchin, who I mentioned, but also Wilbur Ross, who's now the Commerce Secretary, who made a similar deal to the one that I just described, but involving a bank in Florida, Donald Trump's closest friend, Tom Barrack, who organized the inauguration and introduced Ivanka at the Republican National Convention. His company bought up more than 30,000 homes across the country after they had been foreclosed. Steve Schwarzman, another good friend of the president, a billionaire worth about $15 billion, the co-founder of Blackstone, whose company now owns 80,000 single-family homes across more than a dozen states. All of this activity occurred during the Obama years. And then around 2016, when Donald Trump is running for president, and the rest of the smart Wall Street money, remember, was on Hillary, these guys start to coalesce around this renegade billionaire populist from Manhattan named Donald Trump. And then once he gets elected, they then go into power themselves, making rules that impact the rest of us.
And I want to get to how they're trying to deregulate our laws so that they can continue this sort of pillage. But before we do that, staying on how it was that they, under the Obama administration, scooped up these homes with government subsidies, wasn't the Obama administration also making it easier for individuals to buy homes? Wasn't that part of the recovery?
I mean, there were some programs that were designed to help individuals. I mean, for example, we, when we bought our house, we got an $8,000 first-time home buyer tax credit. That was one of the programs that was part of the economic stimulus package. There was also a part of the bank bailout called the Home, it was called HAMP, was the acronym, basically a mortgage modification program to help you renegotiate their loan. Consumers ended up really, really frustrated with that because it was voluntary for the banks to participate in, and it was very difficult to access. So you had this, you know, situation where a program for the people, the public, to access is voluntary and cumbersome and people have trouble. And then on the other hand, the government is just shoveling money at a relatively small group of Wall Street types. And, you know, this continued not only during the bust itself. I mean, a lot of people say, like, well, Aaron, the economy was in a disastrous shape in 2008. People can be forgiven for acting rashly. But it continued for years. So by 2011, the government ends up as the owner of over 200,000 homes across the country because we were backing up these mortgages. They were foreclosed, so they end up in our hands. And then rather than trying to sell them off to one family at a time to stabilize the market while helping, you know, ordinary Americans build wealth, what they did was they bundled them together in bundles of more than 1,000 homes at a time, or up to 1,000 homes at a time, and they sold them off to big Wall Street hedge fund firms, including Tom Barrack's, for just pennies on the dollar. And so it was deemed too complicated, you know, to sell them off to families, but not problematic at all to sell them 1,000 at a time at a deep discount to Wall Street types.
What you just said, I imagine, is causing such a rage among our viewers as it is causing me, just to think about how our own government, that's supposed to represent us, just violated Americans' abilities to own their own homes. Let's sort of, and then of course, just even getting new mortgages became hard as well, right? Because first it was too easy to get a mortgage, and that ended up helping to cause the mortgage crisis. But then, instead of, you know, making it a fair process, didn't it also become way harder for Americans who should have gotten mortgages to buy their first or second homes to actually get them?
Well, I mean, one of the home wreckers I discussed in the book is Jamie Dimon, who's the president and chief of J.P. Morgan Chase, which is the biggest bank in America by assets, which benefited hugely from government support during the housing bust. The government helped him acquire Washington Mutual, which was another failed bank, which allowed him to massively expand his operations to the West Coast, where Chase had not really been before. And after he did that, after we facilitated this, Chase dramatically scaled back its lending to everyday families, you know. And if you look at the mortgage lending that was being made by America's biggest bank, it didn't just go up during the bust. It continued to go down, and the Chase's mortgage lending in 2016 was far below its mortgage lending in 2010. So it was getting harder and harder to get a loan from this big bank if you wanted to buy a house. On the other hand, Chase was lending to these big Wall Street firms. And one of the things that I discuss in the book is the growth of these new mortgage-backed securities. So many of your listeners and viewers may remember that before the bust, what banks would do is, you know, bundle together a whole bunch of mortgages and put them into these gigantic loans and then cut the loans up and sell them on Wall Street. And so then when the housing market started to soften, nobody knew who owned any particular loan, and the entire, you know, economy collapsed. And what Chase is funding now is a new type of mortgage-backed security, but not on individual home loans, but on properties owned by this new class of corporate landlords that I was discussing. So one of the houses that I follow in the book was owned by this woman, Sandy Jolly, and her family had owned it for more than 30 years. Her father worked for the water department out in Ventura County. Her mother helped work at a company that made business and payroll checks. And after their home was foreclosed on and it was sold to Tom Barrack's company, and Sandy ends up paying $42,000 in rent over an 18-month period to continue to live in a home that her parents bought for less than $90,000 back in the 80s. After she got out, the house is still owned by this Wall Street firm, and they are charging increasing amounts of rent. And as the property values go up, they go back again and again to banks like Chase to leverage it into bigger and bigger mortgage-backed securities, to the point where now, if you go look at the property record for her house at 681 Benson Way in Thousand Oaks, California, this 1,500 square foot house with three bedrooms and two bathrooms and a little lawn and a lemon tree out front, you will see a $960 million lien against this little house. It's just, the first time I saw one of these, I could not believe it. But they are becoming more and more common as these properties go into bigger and bigger corporate ownership and bundled more and more. And just like, you know, individual families might have been pulling money out of their house to send their kids to college or fix their roof or remodel their kitchen or deal with a medical bill, these Wall Street firms are pulling billions out in equity. And they don't see a problem with it, and neither do the bond rating agencies that are trying to decide if these bundles are a good bet for investors, because they have tenants in there paying these off, right? Hmm. Paying more and more rent every month to pay out these gigantic bundles of debt that are being taken out against these homes and traded on Wall Street.
Aaron, let's step back and just talk about the importance of home ownership. I mean, of course, there are plenty of people who rent or choose to rent and have always rented because of various reasons. But in general, historically, as you describe in your book, this has been a country that has promoted home ownership. And it's done so because owning a home can actually be one of the few things that helps you create wealth at a rate much faster than just your salary, right? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the average American homeowner is worth $200,000. And this is 100 times more than the average renter. The average renter in America is worth only $2,000. And this is not because homeowners make 100 times more than renters. I mean, I'm a homeowner and I sit next to people at work who make basically the same salary as me, right? But their money is going to their landlord every month and mine is going into equity in my home, right? And what we see is that for most Americans are living in a paycheck to paycheck situation. The average American has only $4,000 in the bank. And if most of the money you're spending is on housing, shelter, food, clothing, transportation, healthcare, then housing is the only one of these major expenses where you have the ability to spend money and save at the same time. So either you're going to be saving money for yourself by paying off your mortgage, or you're going to be building equity and wealth for your landlord by paying rent. And that's why historically, as you mentioned, at least since the 1930s, the government has played a very active role in promoting homeownership. And now we see, you know, that deteriorating with these home wreckers in charge in Washington.
And of course, the home wreckers have invested in the homes of Americans because they're a great investment. You buy them up at a bargain with the help of the government, and then you have rent coming in to help you pay off those homes, and you just keep ratcheting up that rent. It becomes this near endless source of income for these people, right?
I mean, that is correct. And another thing that I write about in the book is how these corporate landlords make lease agreements with their tenants that put more and more of the cost of living in the home onto the tenant. So the standard lease agreement that Sandy Jolly signed to stay in her home on, you know, in Thousand Oaks, you know, the lease said that if the plumbing burst, she would have to fix it. If the window broke, she would have to fix it. These are things that might be traditionally done by a landlord, but these companies are taking greater and greater control of the market. They have incredible market power. Our housing shortage is very acute. People feel like they have few options. And so not only are they charging more and more rent, but they're pushing more of the costs onto the tenant. Without the, if I fix my plumbing as a homeowner, well, then I get the benefit of the increased property value. In this case, they push the maintenance responsibility onto the tenant, but then they get the benefit of the increased property value.
That's incredible. Let's talk about how the phenomenon of the last decade and a half has also exacerbated the racial inequities in home ownership. Housing and racial discrimination have always been an American phenomenon. People of color, in particular Black Americans, have always been pushed out of the housing market, have had a harder time getting home loans and becoming homeowners. In the period of time that your book examines, did that trend continue?
Yeah, we live in a society today where the African American home ownership rate is lower than it was when segregation was legal and discrimination was legal. It is lower now. Only about 4 in 10 African American families own homes. That's worse than the Jim Crow era. And that is because of the actions that took place over the last decade, which I document in the book. So we had banks like Steve Mnuchin's that concentrated their foreclosures in communities of color. Here in California, Steve Mnuchin's One West Bank, they made about 70% of their foreclosures in communities of color. At the same time, when it came to making loans to families to help them buy homes, this bank, which is headquartered in LA, made over 5 years when Steve Mnuchin was in charge, only 3 loans to African-American families to help them buy homes, and only 11 to Hispanic families. So, you know, they are dispossessing people of color of their homes. And then you might argue, well, maybe those particular families just were not responsible. Well, they are totally unable, it seems, to find other families that would be families of color that could help buy homes. And if you look at the pattern and practice of this bank, and you map the branches, It's almost like an old redlining map where the branches kind of assiduously avoid any neighborhoods of color in Southern California. And so this, you know, Steve Mnuchin, who ran this bank, he is now the Treasury Secretary in charge of regulating every American bank.
So let's talk about what it is that these home wreckers, as you've called them, many of whom are now in the Trump administration, are doing to ensure that they can continue wrecking the American dream.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been talking about Steve Mnuchin, who's the Treasury Secretary, which brings us to tax policy, right? And most of your listeners and viewers are probably aware of the tax bill that President Trump signed and the fact that in general, it was a big, big gift to the rich. But there were some special goodies in there, specifically for the home wreckers. So for example, you know, you and I, Sonali, as we're people who get paid a salary to work, we are taxed at basically at the rate of our income, right? How more money we make, the more taxes we pay. The home wreckers, people who own property through LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies, and there are now over 3 million homes and 15 million apartment units in the U.S. that are owned by shell companies, they get to take now, because of the tax bill, a 20% tax deduction just straight off the top. And this is just one of a number of changes that were made to kind of make life easier for corporate landlords and a little bit harder for the rest of us. So, you know, that's what they did to help people who own properties through shell companies. How did they pay for it? By making it so you can no longer deduct the full value of your state and local property tax, right? By making it so that the mortgage interest deduction is capped. So if you're like an average family trying to buy a home, and you're asking, like, can I afford it? Now you're looking at, you know, a slightly less generous tax policy. But if you're a corporate landlord trying to buy 1,000 homes, you're looking at a much more generous tax policy. That's just on money. We talked about racial discrimination. Steve Mnuchin and the Treasury Department have been working very, very hard to change the way that the Community Reinvestment Act is enforced. This is a 1977 law meant to prevent redlining that says that banks have to invest in low-income communities and working-class communities. And, you know, it's all a lot of jargon, but basically at the end of the day, they're making it weaker. For example, you may start seeing fewer bank branches in low and working class communities. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was set up to protect us from these home wreckers, is being defanged. The Fair Housing Act, which banned discrimination, which was signed by President Johnson within days of Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, the terms of that are being changed. So you just go down the list, you know, and while so many of our commentators and our media are focusing on whatever the latest scandal is in the Trump administration, these guys are quietly working away, changing all the rules in a way that will really disadvantage us tremendously.
And of course, that is one of the many reasons that they tolerate Trump and protect his position, regardless of how he may be assaulting the Constitution. Aaron, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for the work you've done. Good luck with the book.
Okay, thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's a two-time Peabody Award winner and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. We've been discussing his new book, Home Wreckers, How a Gang of Wall Street Kingpins, Hedge Fund Magnates, Crooked Banks, and Vulture Capitalists suckered millions out of their homes and demolished the American dream. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO